All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. It's great to see everyone. All right, so wait a second. I think I'm forgetting something. Oh, today's topic is called Forget Me Not. You see, that's what we call a classic setup. Today, we will discuss a question that I know all of you have wondered for many, many years. It's a fundamental question of life. It's one of the major questions, like, why is the sky blue and why is the ocean whatever color it is, and why does the sun rise in the east and set in the west? Like, these are the fundamental questions. And another fundamental question of life is the following: why is it that when a person wants to remember something, what is the classic way of doing it? Tying a knot around your finger. What is the connection between ties, between knots, and memory? What is the connection? I ask you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please weigh in on this. Well, we'll actually explore this tonight. Tonight we talk about forgiveness. We talk about remembrance. We talk about divine mercy. We talk about prayer. We talk about patriarchs. And we talk about Torah. Folks, today we're exploring the Torah portion of Ki Tisa. This is a very unique parsha, in that it's sandwiched right in the middle of our discussion about the Mishkan, about the tabernacle. You see, from the time that the Jews are told that they're going to leave Egypt, the whole goal is to receive the Torah, and after they receive the Torah, the next step is to build a home for God, to build a tabernacle. But in between the instruction, at least the way it's printed in the Torah, the way it's written in the Torah, in between the instruction to build a Mishkan and the actual execution of that building, again, the way it's written in the Torah, we have a story that jumps in right in the middle. So there's two Torah portions in which we read about the divine command to build a Mishkan, to build a tabernacle. Two portions in which we read about how they built it. And in the middle, there's a portion that talks about one of the darkest moments of Jewish history, collective Jewish history, one of the greatest mistakes that the Jewish people made as a collective nation. And that is, of course, what's the sin? Sin of the golden calf.
Idol worship.
Idol worship. American Idol. I'm just saying. Okay, idol worship, sin of the golden calf. So what happens? 554, 555, the Torah portion begins. And it begins innocently enough. It talks about donating a half shekel. Hey, listen, donations are always good, fundraisers. We have a discussion about the urn. This is where the Kohanim, the priests, would wash their hands and feet. We talk about the anointing oil. I'm just going through some pages here. 559, we have the incense. Don't worry, no one was upset. This is the type of incense he was incensed. No, this was an odorous, which is, I don't know if that's good or bad, but this was a sweet-smelling incense burned in the temple each day. Then we have appointment of Betzalel and Aliyav. These are the people, these are the individuals who are tasked with actually constructing and overseeing the construction of the Mishkan. Then we have a discussion about Shabbat, which juxtaposes the building of the Mishkan with the observance of Shabbat. Although it's important to build this building for God, nonetheless, don't build it on the seventh day of the week, don't build it on Shabbos. And from here we learn that the 39 categories of work that were done to build the Mishkan are those specific categories of work that are not to be done on Shabbat. And the Mishnah and Jewish law details what those categories are. And then, suddenly, out of nowhere, without any warning, the narrative of the sin of the golden calf gets dropped on us, 562, 563 in your class of Gutnik edition. Suddenly, we have a story, a tale of sorrow, a tale of literal tragedy, that ends, that radically shifts the course of the Jewish people's existence pretty much forever. So what happens is, just to recap the story, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, know it, but let's just recap it for the background information. So what happens is Moses goes up, God gives us the Torah on the sixth day of Sivan, the year 2448 from creation. The next day, seventh day of Sivan, Moses ascends the mountain. And he tells the people, listen, when I get back, I'll be back in 40 days. Make sure to have a pizza for me. He doesn't say that. I'm kidding. But he does say, I'll be back 40 days. He didn't eat for 40 days and 40 nights. right? You didn't eat. But what Moses does say is, I'll be back in 40 days. The people begin counting that day as day number one. The mistake is, it wasn't a full day. How can you count that as day one if it's already halfway through the day? So that's not a day. A day is a full day, 24-hour unit, starting from the evening and heading into the morning and the rest of the day before sun sets once again. So they counted that as day one. 40 days later, to the people's count, they're concerned. They're looking at the clock. They're looking at the watches. Where's Moses? What's going on? He's tearing. He's delaying. Where is he? And they begin to panic, and they begin to have thoughts about perhaps creating other forms of leadership and deification. Let's read this inside. Ray, please get us started. 563, where you see, right in the middle of the page, 563, Sin of the Golden Calf.
When he had finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, telling him the laws that are found in Parsha Mishpatim, he gave Moshe the two tablets of the testimony, stone tablets written with the finger of God. The people saw that Moshe was delayed in coming down from the mountain. The people gathered against Aharon, and they said to him, "Come on, make us gods that will go before us and lead us. Because as for this man Moshe, who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him."
By the way, you have to love the subtle vote of confidence for Aharon, right? It's like, your brother's gone. We need a new leader. Make something for us. They didn't ask Aaron to be the leader, right? They're like, create other gods, create a golden calf. Continue, please.
Aaron said to them, "Take the golden earrings off the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me," hoping to delay them until Moshe came down.
Look, it's one thing to ask people for contributions to build, you know, the tabernacle. Here it's to build a golden calf. We need gold. Aaron thinks he's got a perfect plan. Say, ask your wives, your sons, your daughters for their gold jewelry. Not going to happen. Right?
He didn't say ask. He said take them.
Yeah, but you know, take is ask. Well, hopefully not. No. In fact, the commentators explain that Aaron was sure that certainly the women, the Jewish women, would not participate in this whole situation. And they would say, no, seriously, that's not happening. And not because they like their jewelry also, but primarily because, what are you going to do with it? Oh, we're building golden calf. Why? Idol worship. Really? Not happening. Nonetheless, here's what happens next. Continue, please. 565.
All the people stripped themselves of the golden earrings that were on their ears immediately and brought them to Aaron.
The implication being not necessarily the women, but others who had golden earrings. Now, you may be asking, what were the sons doing with earrings?
Right.
Right? And did the men have earrings? Is that the implication here? Join us next week as we explore jewelry in Jewish history. I don't know the answer, but it seems clear that there were some sort of adornments that were happening. Continue.
He took the rings from their hands, tied it up in a cloth, and sorcerers from the mixed multitude made it into a molten calf. They, the mixed multitude, said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who have brought you up from the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw that the golden calf had life in it, he built an altar in front of it to push them off further. Aaron called out and said, "Tomorrow should be a festival to God," for he was sure that Moshe would come down by then.
So now you have this golden calf, and you're thinking like, oh, great. And it's got animation. It moves. It's somehow infused with some sort of vitality. So he says, okay, let's put the brakes on this. Let's pick this up tomorrow. By tomorrow, Moshe will be back down, and all, you know, everything will be restored back to sanity. Well, continue, please.
On the next day, they arose early, offered up burnt offerings, and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink, and they became depraved.
Well, there you have it. So they beat him to the punch. They wake up early. They're like, we got to get an early start here. You know, when you go on vacation, there are the family members that want to wake up late and the family members that want to wake up early, right? So there's the ones that have like the map. It's like, we're ready to go. It's like 6 a.m. It's like vacation. No, 6 a.m. We got to hit. If we hit this and then hit that and hit that, it's going to be an amazing day and we'll pack it in. Then you have the other person that says, pack it in. I want to sleep a little bit. I'm on vacation. So Aaron says, tomorrow will be a festival. Come to me at noon tomorrow. He doesn't maybe specify, but he's thinking, you know, we'll wake up, we'll get ready for the festival, we'll put up the balloons, we'll decorate a cake. It's going to take a little while before things get rolling. By that time, Moses will be down. Meanwhile, they wake up. They're like, let's go, Disney. I mean, we got to serve this golden calf. Let's go. Let's get moving. We got to get cracking. The lines are going to get too long otherwise. So meanwhile, next thing you know, they're worshiping idols and all... And everything is now off the rails. Before we turn the page, and we're actually at some point going to switch back to the translation that's in our books, our Torah studies books, just because it's a little simpler for our discussion, I want to also point out something else. There was a relative of Moshe and Aaron, actually Moshe and Aaron's nephew, the son of Miriam. His name was Chor. Chor was opposing this whole situation. And he said, stop. What are you doing? This is crazy. You can't build a golden calf. This is nuts. Like, what are you doing? And they killed him. They killed him. He sought to stop it, and they killed him.
What was the relationship? It was
like, he was Miriam. Oh, Miriam. Remember, it's three siblings, Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe, Miriam's son.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Moshe and Aaron's nephew. So the people meant business, and they were not going to be stopped, and they served the idols, and now... Yeah, and now the golden calf has happened. So here's what I want to point out. This is not on our topic of the class, but I do want to point out something that I find, from a literary perspective, is fascinating. This story of the golden calf opens up with a very interesting preamble, if you will. A very interesting opening verse. If you look back, the first verse that Ray read was that after God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, he gave Moses what? Two stone tablets. This is important in our narrative. I'm just pointing out from a narrative literary perspective. We have this visual of God giving Moses the tablets, which will then come into play when Moses comes down, spoiler alert, comes down from the mountain, witnesses the golden calf worship. What happens? Moses takes said tablets, because if he didn't mention the tablets before, what was he doing holding the tablets? So we have to drop that piece of info, again, from a literary perspective. You have to drop the info about the tablets before... And then you can talk about him smashing the tablets. Now the narrative makes sense. But let's talk about what happens in the interim. So again, the people express their concern about Moses, their interest in getting another leader. They approach Aaron. Aaron tries to push them off. They get the gold. Somehow sorcery happens. Who knows? There's different opinions actually as to how it happened. It's not relevant for right now. The golden calf becomes somewhat animated. Again, Aaron tries to push him up to the next day. They wake up early. They worship. Chor is killed at some point in this whole debacle. And then God speaks to Moses and tells him, you need to go down. Something terrible has happened. Remember, Moses is oblivious to what's going on. God obviously is not oblivious. God tells Moses something terribly wrong has happened. Actually,
not
Joshua. No, God tells Moses. No, yeah. God tells Moses, who he's been communicating for 40 days, and this is the real day 40. In other words, the next day, the real day 40, the people worshiping the golden calf. So this is what happens. Let's, Sarah, pick it up from here, 567, where it says Moshe calms God's anger.
God said sternly to Moshe, go down, for your people that you have brought up from the land of Egypt have become corrupt. They have rapidly abandoned the way which I commanded them. They made themselves a molten calf. They bowed down to it, slaughtered sacrifices to it, and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who have brought you up from the land of Egypt. God said to Moshe, I have observed this people, and look, they are stiff-necked people who do not like being rebuked. Times do not change.
Yeah.
Now leave me alone.
Wait a second. Are you rebuking us for not liking rebuke? I don't like that. I'm kidding. That's the whole thing. Continue.
Now leave me alone, and my anger will be kindled against them, and I will annihilate them. I will make you into a great nation instead.
Please continue.
Moshe pleaded before God, his God, and said, why, O God, should your anger be kindled against your people, whom you have brought up in the land of Egypt with great power and with a strong hand? Why should the Egyptians say, he brought them out with evil intent to kill them in the mountains and to annihilate them from the face of the earth? Withdraw from the heat of your anger. Change your mind about doing evil to your people. Remember Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yisroel, your servants, to whom you yourself swore when you said to them, I will multiply your seed like the stars of the heavens. All this land which I promised you, I will give to your descendants, and they will possess it forever. God changed his mind about the evil that he had said he would do to his people.
You understand what's going on here? Sight unseen, Moshe says you have to forgive the people. He doesn't even go down. He doesn't even say to God, okay, it sounds terrible. This is all on top of the mountain or in heaven. You with me on this? God tells Moshe, the people have served idols, and I will destroy them. And Moshe says, you can't. What are the Egyptians going to say? Right? What are the patriarchs going to say? You're breaking the promise. Can't do this. Sight unseen, he does not know the damage. Moses did not observe what happened. He says, it doesn't matter what happened. You still have to forgive them. For what? For why? I don't know. You know what happened, God. Whatever it is, you still have to forgive them. This is Moses. That's why he's Moses. This is why Moses is Moses. Moses is the dude. I mean, he's like, who does this? Who stands up for someone without even knowing what the details of what happened? It's irrelevant what they did. You still have to forgive them. That's basically the argument. Let's bring it back. So what happens is, at that point, God basically expresses his consent to forgive the people in general, not the direct individuals who created and worshiped the golden calf, but the rest of the people God forgives. What happens next is, we're going to paraphrase now, 567, Moses goes down and does smash the tablets in front of the people. The perpetrators of the calf, the golden calf, are punished, the direct perpetrators. The ringleaders were punished. 573, we talk about Moshe's private tent of meeting. He's a little bit separate from the camp because the people were steeped in idolatry at that point, so he kind of like set up shop a little bit away from everyone else. 575 is where the narrative picks up and gets fascinating. Some of the most mysterious verses in the Torah, certainly some of the more mysterious conversations between God and Moshe are contained in these passages, but as I mentioned before, let's look at these inside our Torah studies books or booklets. It'll be a little bit easier to follow without some of the parentheses and the commentaries that are interwoven in our Chumash translation. So for our purposes, let's go inside. So let's take a look at text 1D. We're going to read text 1D and text 1E. This is page 135 and 136. What happens, I need to fill in a few pieces. Moses is up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. He comes down after the sin of the golden calf, smashes the tablets. At that point, the justice is served for the perpetrators, the direct perpetrators of the golden calf. And then what does Moses do? He goes back up the mountain a second time for 40 days and 40 nights. And at that point, he gains a second set of tablets. He asks for forgiveness. Full forgiveness after having assessed what happened on the ground. God grants full forgiveness. Then Moses comes back down the mountain, goes back up a third time, and gets a second set of tablets, comes down with the second tablets after the third set of 40 days. And that day that Moses comes down with the tablets is the day of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, where all is restored and the tablets are, now we have whole tablets once again. So it's symbolic of this circle of complete tshuva, of complete return back to a place of wholeness. Let's focus on the second set of 40 days. First set is when Moses is learning Torah from God, and then he comes down and smashes the tablets. The second set of 40 days is when Moses does the primary work outside of the initial conversation of, well, we have to forgive, but Moses does the primary work of asking and requesting and facilitating forgiveness for the Jewish people. Here's a conversation that happens during these 40 days, the second set of 40 days, text 1D. Mike, please take it away.
And Moses said, show me now your glory. He said, I will let all my goodness pass before you. I will proclaim the name of God before you. And I will favor when I wish to favor. And I will have compassion when I wish to have compassion. And he said, you will not be able to see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And God said, behold, there is a place with me, and you shall stand on the rock. And it shall be that when my glory passes by, I will place you into the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face shall not be seen.
Somebody tell me what's going on here. What is Moses asking, and what is God responding? What does Moshe ask for? What does he say?
Let me see you.
See God.
Yeah.
He figures, look, God is acquiescing. God is agreeing to forgive the Jewish people. It's an eight ratzon. It's an auspicious time. Things are working out. He's getting his request granted. So he figures, let me ask the biggest request possible, to see the face of God. I want to see God's presence. And what does God say? What's the short answer?
No.
Can't happen. You can't happen. You can see my back, you can't see my front, which, by the way, we're going to discuss what that means. Right? Does God have a body?
Yes, right. Can.
God.
Because it says.
Yeah, and what does that mean?
I don't know.
So we have a classic teaching of Maimonides that all of the physical language, the bodily language that's used in Torah regarding God, is all meant to be understood on an allegorical level, not a literal level. So it's not a hand, it's not a front, it's not a back. We'll explore this a little bit more as we go through tonight's class. But the point of it is that whatever front and back mean, God says, you can't see my face, the front of me, you can see the back of me, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, cover you with my hand, etc. Now, a few verses later, let's continue, a few verses later, we have another interaction between Moses and God, text 1e. Dan, please read this one.
And God descended in a cloud and stood with him there. And he called out in the name of God. God passed before him and proclaimed, Lord, Lord, benevolent God, who is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness and truth, preserving loving kindness for thousands, forgiving iniquity and rebellion and sin, yet he does not completely clear of sin. He visits the iniquity of parents on children and children's children to the third and fourth generations. Moses hastened, bowed his head to the ground, and prostrated himself.
Thank you. Another very mysterious conversation, dialogue, passage, etc. What happens here? So God descends in the cloud, and he stands with Moses, and who calls out in the name of God? It says, and he called out in the name of God. Who called out in the name of God?
Well, that capital H is just
God. God called out in his own name. What does that mean? Right? And God passed before him and proclaimed, Lord, Lord, benevolent God, who is compassionate and gracious. Who's speaking? God. About whom?
About himself.
He's saying, this is who I am. So what's going on? God is telling Moses who he is, that he's compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, and why? Okay. So the commentaries, the Jewish sages throughout the ages decode what is going on in this passage. And as well in the previous passage. Text 1D and text 1E, the first conversation where Moses says, show me your glory, and God says, you can't see it. And the second conversation where God is speaking about himself, almost in third person, these are two episodes, one of godly revelation, where God reveals himself to Moses on a certain level, God makes himself present on a certain level, and the second where God teaches Moses the key to prayer. Let's focus on the second passage first, the one that we just read, text 20. So, God says to Moses, essentially, if you want to pray and ask for forgiveness, you use the methodology before, but that methodology you might not always be able to go to the bank with. What was the methodology? What was the angle that Moses took? We read before. When he first spoke to God and said, forgive the people, he had two points of the argument. What was the second angle that he took for forgiveness? He said, do it for the sake of the patriarchs, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He said, well, what are the Egyptians going to say? Like, what are the neighbors going to say? Right, what are the Egyptians going to say? Fine. But the next argument was, the patriarchs, do it in the merit of the patriarchs. And what God is saying is that you can't always go to the patriarchs. You can't always pull the patriarchs card. However, if you really want to seek my grace, my forgiveness, my kindness and my love, recite the 13 attributes of mercy, Lord, Lord, benevolent God, who is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness and truth, preserving loving kindness for thousands. Those are the 13 attributes of mercy, Yod Gimel, Midot, Harachamim, 13 attributes of mercy, and God is teaching Moses a formula of prayer. And God does it, God models it, by reciting the prayer about himself. God says, if you want to pray for forgiveness, or if the Jewish people ever want to pray for forgiveness, say these words, and God says the words to Moses. How do I know this? Let's take a look at text. What is it? I don't even know anymore. Text 2. Rashi. And
I will proclaim the name of God before you to teach you the procedure for begging for compassion, that is praying, even if the merit of the patriarchs is depleted. According to this procedure, during which you will see me enwrapped in a tallit and proclaim the 13 attributes, teach the Israelites to do likewise. Through their mentioning before me the words compassionate and gracious, they will be answered. For my compassion never ends.
God says to Moses, you're going to the patriarch card, you know, you're going to that well often, or whatever, you're going to that well. It may not always work. Therefore, I am going to wrap myself in a tallit in a prayer shawl. And I'm going to say the 13 attributes of mercy. Listen carefully, memorize it, teach it to the people. And if you ever need my compassion, grace, forgiveness, etc., say this prayer. And so, we do. We recite it every single day. In fact, twice a day. The morning prayers, the afternoon prayers, after the Amida, when we recite the confessional prayers known as Tachnun, we recite the 13 attributes of mercy. And we recite it on special days, in the Slichot, in the days preceding the high holidays, on the high holidays themselves. Anytime we ask for divine forgiveness and mercy and compassion, we recite this formula of the 13 attributes of mercy, taught originally to Moses by none other than God himself. Take a look at text number 3. Jillian.
Whoever understands these 13 attributes and invokes them with a correct intention in prayer will never find his prayer unanswered. In these times when we find ourselves in exile, without a high priest to atone for us, nor an altar upon which to offer sacrifices, nor a temple in which to pray, nothing remains with which to appear before God save our prayer and his 13 attributes.
Rabbeinu Bechaya says, what do we have today? If we want to ask for God's forgiveness, compassion, mercy, etc., what do we have? We have prayer and the Yud Gimel Midot, the 13 attributes of divine mercy. And so it's very special, a very special formula, again, recited to this very day in our prayers. Now, that's all the second mysterious passage. What about the first mysterious passage? Moses wants to see God's glory, he puts him in the cleft of the rock, puts his hand over him, you can't see my face, you can only see my back. What's going on? I'm glad you asked. Text number 5, the Midrash addresses this. Karen, please read this one.
Moses spoke before the Holy One, blessed be he, sovereign of all the universe. Show me now your glory. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to him, Moshe, you are not able to see my glory, lest you should die, as it is said, for men shall not see me and live. But for the sake of the oath which I have sworn to you, I will do as you ask. Stand at the entrance of the cave, and I will make all the angels who move before me pass before your face. Stand mighty, and do not fear, as it is said. And he said, I will let all my goodness pass before you. When you hear the name which I have spoken to you, you'll know I am before you, as it is said. And he said, I will let all my goodness pass before you. The ministering angels said, now we serve before him by day and by night, and we are unable to see his glory. And this one, born of woman, desires to see his glory?
Born of woman, meaning a human being of flesh and blood. That's an expression. Yulud Isha, a human being. So us angels can't see your glory. And now you're going to grant it to Moses? It's not fair. Continue.
And they arose in wrath and excitement to slay him, and his soul came close to death. What did the Holy One, blessed be he, do? He revealed himself unto him in a cloud, as it is said, and God descended in the cloud. This was the seventh descent.
Listen, I know, like technology and computers and businesses, everything's in the cloud. But God was the first one to be in the cloud. All right, continue.
The Holy One, blessed be he, protected him with the hollow of his hand, that he should not die, as it is said. And it shall be that when my glory passes by, I will place you into the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand. When the Holy One, blessed be he, had passed by, he removed the hollow of his hand from him, and he saw the traces of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, as it is said, then I will remove my hand and you will see my back.
And you can already see already in the Midrash that the front and the back and the hand, they're not literal, but it's metaphorical. It's like Moses wants to see the full picture and God says, I'll grant you some of my Shekhinah, some of my presence, traces of the divine presence, but not the whole deal. You know, the difference between front and back is when you see the back of a person, you know they're there, but you can't really identify who they are. I mean, sometimes you can more than others, but from the front, you see someone's face, they're more immediately identifiable. From the back, it's more of a silhouette. So it's not as discernible. So the front and the back vis-a-vis, again, in this metaphorical understanding, Moses wants to see everything God in his full glory and all the details. And God says, I'm going to give you some sort of glimpse, but not the whole deal. The angels weren't even happy about that. And that whole drama ensued. Okay. Yes.
First, second, or third, when they heard his voice, didn't some of them die?
First two commandments.
And at the top of page 575, what does it mean? God would speak to Moshe face to face as a man would speak to his friend.
Moses was able to face to face, direct verbal communication, but not necessarily visual, right? He spoke to him directly, but that doesn't necessarily imply that Moses saw him face to face. He spoke to him face to face, but not necessarily did he see him on that level.
One of those filter things.
It's a filter. Always goes back to the filter, the voice disguiser. Yeah.
Well, I also love, and I don't know if it's how it translates, if it's what it really says in Hebrew, but I love that it says, I will let all my goodness pass before you. It's a very different thing than, you know, a corporal.
Yeah.
You know.
Let's see what it is. It is. Ani aver kol tuvi apanecha. Yeah, goodness, like tov. Oh my goodness. My goodness. Okay, now, let's continue 6a. 6a is the key text that we're really going to focus on. All right, page 142.
Well, can I ask one?
Oh, sure.
What the seventh descent? Can you?
Yeah. Apparently, there were other times where God appeared or God made himself present and God descended to come down. You know, one of the famous descents is where God says, let me descend and see what's happening in Sodom and Gomorrah before he overturns the city. So that's an example. Seven times the Torah talks about God descending and kind of visiting the human condition. So this is number seven according to the Midrash account. Text 6a, David, please read this, page 142 from the Talmud.
I will remove my hand and you will see my back. Rabbi Chana bar Bizna said in the name of Rabbi Shimon Chasida, God showed Moshe the knot of his tefillin.
Listen to this. The Talmud says, what does it mean when God says, I'll remove my hand when I pass by and then you'll see my back? What does it mean that Moses was supposed to see his back, God's back? Specifically, Kesher Shel Tefillin. The Tefillin knot. Which knot of the Tefillin is in the back? The one that's on the head. Right, there's two tefillin. There's the arm tefillin that has a knot that's the inside of the arm facing the heart. And then you have the head tefillin, which has a box in the front, two straps that go around the head, and there's a knot in the back. And then two straps that kind of hang down from there. But the knot is in the back. So the Talmud says, when God tells Moshe, I'm going to pass before you, cover your eye, I will cover your eyes, and then I'll remove my hand and you'll see my back. What part of God did he see? Kesher shel tefillin, the knot of the tefillin. What does that mean? Let's continue Rashi text 6b, if you don't mind reading one more.
The knot of his tefillin, the knot is behind him, as the knot of the head tefillin normally is. And we already said earlier in the Talmud that God wears tefillin.
So God wears tefillin. By the way, what is it saying God's tefillin? In our tefillin, it talks about God. It says, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Hear Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. It talks about God. What does it say in God's tefillin? Umi ka'amcha Yisrael go echad ba'aretz. Who is like the nation of Israel, one nation on earth? So that's what it says in God's tefillin. That's what our sages tell us. Our tefillin talks about God, and God's tefillin talks about us. Fine. We have a lot of questions now, and let's focus on this question about, or this detail about the knot of the tefillin. Number one, what is the meaning of God's tefillin knot? What does that mean? What does it mean, God's knot of tefillin? Why did God allow Moses to see specifically the tefillin knot and not the rest of the tefillin, or not the straps? What's specific about the knot of the tefillin? What does that mean conceptually? Number one. Number two, what's the connection between God showing Moses? Because remember, the first, we had two narratives. One narrative is about God's revelation to Moses, and the next one is about God teaching Moses and the Jewish people how to pray. Fantastic. So if we distill it based on the Talmudic discussion, right, if we distill it down, when Moses says, show me your glory, at the end of the day, what does God show Moses? After all of the discussion and all of the fancy language and all the cryptic terminology, what does God show Moses? The knot of his tefillin. Okay, I know. Foreshadowing. Like, it's like the tablets in Moses' hands, which are going to come into play later. Right. Hold on. So at that whole first narrative of God saying, show me your face, show me your glory, and at the end of the day, what does he see? God's tefillin. Well, what does that mean? Number one, what does that mean? Number two, what is the connection between that narrative of God showing Moses his knot of the tefillin and the second narrative where God teaches Moses how to pray and ask for forgiveness and mercy and compassion? What's the connection between these two narratives thematically? Since they're juxtaposed, there seems to be some sort of connection. What is it? And of course, the question we always like to ask, what is the payoff for us? What is the eternal lesson? Torah means instruction. Torah is a book of guidance and life direction. So what is the direction that you and I can apply to our own lives from these stories? The story of God showing Moses the knot of his tefillin, and the second story of God teaching Moses how to pray and ask for forgiveness. What does it mean? What's the connection? And what do we do with it? So, let's talk about knots. And now we focus on the concept of a knot. So, the first question I'll ask is, where do we find knots in Torah? Where do we find knots in Torah? Well, we already have one, right? In Jewish observance, we have tefillin. The tefillin has knots. What else has knots? Tzitzit, right? The prayer shawl. That's what it sounds like when it rains pretty hard here. Nice. So you have a prayer shawl, a four-corner garment, and at the corners of the four-corner garment, we could probably pull a talit from somewhere and demonstrate it. We should probably do that. Who wants to volunteer? I think they are... Mike, you got it. Thank you. They're right in that corner behind the trees. Careful, some of them are covering the Torahs because we're rebuilding our ark over there. So make sure you're pulling one that's unoccupied. So while Mike is gone, kidding. So, the four-corner garment has strings, and people wear it over their clothing when they pray, and many have the custom to wear it under their clothing all day long. I like to tell people, if you need anything, I can always pull some strings. Thank you very much. Todat rabah. Thank you. Now, I do what I can. These are the corners, and these are the strings. There are four strings that are doubled over to form eight. Make sense? If you have four strings and you double them over, you have now eight ends of strings. They are knotted. There are five knots. So you take... You take the two bundles of four, you make a knot, then you weave one, the longest thread, around the coil, around the whole collection of the other seven. You make another knot, another two knots, whatever. And you keep on going around. If you wanted to, if you've seen it, you know it. If you want to inspect it, you certainly can. This is what it looks like. One, two, three, four, five segments of knots with coils of the tzitzit, the coils of the strands of the thread that are interspersed between those knots. So that's another example of knots. We have the tefillin knots and the talit, the tzitzit knots. What's the significance? Take a look at text 7a and 7b. Danny.
And it shall be to you as a sign upon your hand and as a remembrance between your eyes, in order that the law of God shall be in your mouth. For with a mighty hand God took you out of Egypt. And you shall keep this statute at its appointed time from year to year.
Now, this is the commandment of wrapping tefillin. It's a sign on your hand, on your arm, and it's a remembrance between your eyes, on your head, center between the eyes. So, that is about the tefillin. Let's talk about the tzitzit. Text 7b, please continue.
God spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and you shall say to them that they shall make for themselves fringes on the corners of their garments throughout their generation, and they shall affix a thread of sky blue wool on the fringe of each corner. This shall be fringes for you, and when you see it, you will remember all the commandments of your God to perform them, and you shall not wander after your hearts and after your eyes, after which you are going astray, so that you shall remember and perform all my commandments, and you shall be holy to your God.
What is common to the theme of tefillin and tzitzit? What is common to what theme is common to both?
Remember.
Exactly. Zechira, remembrance. When the tefillin are remembrance, remember the Exodus. And the tzitzit are also remembrance. Remember all the mitzvot, all the commandments of God, to perform them, etc. Both are about remembrance, and both I mentioned before have, in the physical structure, have knots. Both have knots, and both are about remembrance. You should know, it's not incidental and it's not coincidental. Rather, there's an intrinsic connection between memory and tying knots. The Torah says, tie the knots of the tefillin and you'll remember the Exodus. Tie the knots of the tzitzit and you'll remember the commandments. I want to share with you some texts, classic Jewish texts, about the connection between tying knots and remembering things. In other words, knots is a memory aid. Text number 8. I'll read some text now to kind of move quickly through this. Page 145. This comes from Kabbalah, the book of Zohar. Rabbi Yossi said, praise be this way. Let me explain. He said, praise be this path, this road, that it merited to this teaching. They said to him, from whom did you hear it? Very vague so far, but it's gonna be a little bit clearer soon. He said to them, one day I was walking on the way, and I heard and saw Rabbi Hamnuna Saba expounding upon this verse to Rabbi Acha, and when I heard it, I was overjoyed. So, what did he do? I tied a knot on the edge of my garment so the teaching would never depart from me. Forget the first half of it. The importance here for us is the second half, where he says, I heard a wondrous teaching on this road. And to not forget it, what did I do? I tied a knot on the fringes on the edge of my garment. So we see here an ancient mention of tying knots to help remember. Take a look at text number 9. I'm going to read a bunch of texts now. Text number 9. The Torah tells us the famous story of Joseph. Imprisoned, Joseph was framed. Joseph gave a good interpretation, a dream interpretation to the butler, and he asked the butler to remember him when the butler becomes free. The Torah tells us, and the butler, text 9, did not remember Joseph and forgot him. The Midrash comments, text number 10, the butler did not remember all day. He would set reminders. What do you think? Google Calendar reminders? Alarm clocks? No, he would set reminders, and an angel would overturn them. The angel wanted Joseph in prison for 2 more years. So he would make plans to remember, and the angel would cause him to forget. What did he do, and what did the angel undo? He would tie knots, and an angel would loosen them. You hear what's going on? He would be tying knots all day, and the angel would loosen them, and he could never remember. You ever have a thing that you're trying to remember, and you keep on forgetting? Yeah? And you keep on trying to set reminders for yourself, and every time you forget. I have a thing, and I can't remember what it is. I know what it is now. I have a thing that I need it always occurs to me on Shabbat when I can't take care of it. And I cannot, for some reason, it's going on for a few months already, during the week when I could remedy the situation, I can't seem to recall it. Now I'm recalling it now. So folks got to go. Now, so nonetheless, you know, sometimes you try to remember and you can't remember. He tried to remember Joseph, but he couldn't. But what did he do? He tied knots. Let's take a look at text number 11. Text number 11, the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, explains that that's why, literally, that tzitzit are a reminder for Torah and the mitzvot. Think about it. How many knots? I dropped this clue before. Everything is calculated. How many knots does this have? Each corner has five. How many books of the Torah? That was my mic drop. How many books of the Torah? Five. Text 11. One is not obligated to buy a garment with four corners so that he will be required to attach tzitzit to it. In other words, you don't have to wear a garment of four corners and then have the strings. How? Rather, only if he desires to wear a four-corner garment is he required to attach tzitzit. Nevertheless, it is preferable and appropriate for everyone to be careful and eager to wear a talit with tzitzit throughout the day. We call it a talit katan under the garment, so that he will remember the mitzvot at every moment. To explain, by example, if someone cautions his friend to remember something, the friend will tie a knot in his belt as a reminder. Look, this is the code of Jewish law. This is what people do. You tie a knot. Accordingly, the tzitzit at each corner have five knots, which recall the five books of the Torah, and there are four corners, so that whichever direction a person turns, he'll remember the mitzvot. I didn't see it. I was there. No, you got some over there. Got one there. All directions you have. In all four directions, you have five knots, reminds us of the Torah and the mitzvot. It's beautiful. Straight up, the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, the Alter Rebbe's Code of Jewish Law, that's what it says regarding tzitzit. What do we see from all this? That for some reason, tying knots has been used. I'm not talking about when you were a kid and like there was the whole thing of tying a string around your finger, tying a knot around your finger. I'm talking about, this is not like, you know, America custom or anecdotal Western society. This is ancient Jewish teachings. This is Zohar. This is Midrash. This is Code of Jewish Law. References, dropping references to tying knots to remember, which then begs the question, this is how we started the class. Hold on, what was the question again? Kidding. The question is, why is it that when we try to remember, we want to remember something, we tie a knot? What is it about tying a knot and memory? Makesher, no pun intended. What's the connection, right? What's the connection between knots and memory? To understand this, we need to present a fundamental Jewish and Kabbalistic truth. And that is what I like to call the basic law of spiritual gravity. And what is the basic law of spiritual gravity? Well, physical gravity states, the law of physical gravity is that everything is pulled downward. Some dude discovered that when he got hit in the head with an apple, apparently, right? Or something like that, maybe? Yes? Newton? Yeah? Maybe a fig? Newton hit him or something? Whatever. I don't know why it took someone, like, but no one ever dropped something before and wonder why it didn't go up. Like, what's the... We have to explore that further and figure out what was the big... What was the big chidush? Like, what actually happened? Like, oh my God, like everyone, like for all time up until then, people were dropping things and they were just levitating. Okay, whatever, let's get back to our discussion. So that's physical gravity, that things go down. Spiritual gravity is pretty much the same. Actually, it's the same law, but it's about spiritual things. And what is it? It's not the reverse. What does it say? Or what does it mean? Spiritual law of gravity is that whatever you see down here came from up there. Whatever, anything that's physical has a spiritual origin. Quoting the Talmud says, there is no blade of grass that doesn't possess an angel standing above it and telling it, commanding it to grow. Every physical element has a spiritual force that drives it. In other words, this is the end of an evolutionary or devolutionary process where spirit becomes matter. And therefore, if we want to look at memory and forgetfulness and knots and understand it, we need to go to the origin. And let's talk about the spiritual meaning of remembering and forgetting. And you can't talk about the spiritual meaning of remembering and forgetting without talking about God. and human beings. Where was the first time that the human being forgot God? First time.
The Garden
of Eden, Adam and Eve. God said, don't eat from the tree. And what happens? Next thing you know, they're eating from the tree. What happened? You forgot? Well, we forgot. We weren't paying attention. We neglected. It's kind of like they forgot, right? They kind of forgot. They weren't wearing tzitzit. They weren't wearing anything, right? Let alone tzitzit. Exactly. That's the point you were making. Right. So, wasn't a whole day. It was like a few hours, and they forgot. They forgot. Forgetfulness, in the spiritual understanding, forgetfulness is a sin. Because it means that, especially when it comes to God and important things, what it means is that you have pulled away your attention, and you have, in a sense, disconnected. Forgetfulness is the same as disconnection. Remembrance or memory is the same as connection. If you're remembering something, if you're recalling something, you're connected with it. If you are unaware of it, if you forgot it, if it's absent from your mind, it means there's a certain disconnect, correct? Make sense? So remembrance, memory is connection. Forgetfulness or forgetting is disconnection. So what happens when a person sins? What happens is we have here a colossal case of forgetfulness, i.e. disconnection. All sin is disconnection. Sin is a person disconnecting themselves from what God wants at that moment. A person says, this is what you want. Okay, I'm going to do something else. Person is disconnecting themselves. Now, a person can never truly be disconnected, but in their own mind, at least, at that moment, they're making a choice that pulls them away from where God wants them to be, and on some level. This is synonymous with the notion of forgetfulness. So let's take a look at text 13a, page 149.
Maybe they didn't forget, they were just tempted too much.
Here's the thing. I'll ask you a question. Did they regret it afterwards?
I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, we know they did. And therefore, if you regret it afterwards, it means that when you're thinking about it, you know that it can't be done and it shouldn't be done and you would never do it. But at that moment, you pushed it, whether you forgot it by accident or you consciously push it out of your mind. Look, anyone, I used this example last night in a different context, anyone that's, or maybe at another class recently, maybe not last night, I don't know anymore. Anyone that's ever hurt someone, said something hurtful, done something disrespectful, etc., has, on some level, forgotten about that person. And it's possible that it's intentional. It's like, I'm going to push them out so that I can do this thing that I know or say this thing that I know is going to be hurtful. Because if they were fully in my consciousness, and I felt connected, I couldn't actually hurt a loved one. I'm talking about a loved one, right? I couldn't actually hurt them at that moment. It's only because of a disconnection, whether accidentally or on purpose, it's only because of a disconnection that one can do something that harms that relationship. Text 13a. The notion of sin in general derives from forgetfulness. Forgetfulness itself derives from the concealment of godliness. Whereas in the realm of holiness, there is no forgetfulness before the throne of your glory. Now, Jews are believers, the son of believers. Ma'aminim b'nei ma'aminim. Every Jew believes that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and everything within them, and that he's constantly creating the world every day and every moment from absolute nothingness. The question arises, when a Jew profoundly feels that in this very moment, he or she has been created by God, and that in the next moment, he or she must depend on the word of God anew to continue creating them ex nihilo, how can a Jew fail to carry out God's will to not fulfill his desire? The Jew's desire, as part of his very existence, depends on God's will to create the Jew at this very moment. In other words, if you know the truth, and we're assuming that we do, that God is the creator, and not only once upon a time, but God is recreating and re-energizing and reanimating every single moment and bring everything into existence, something from nothing. If that's the case, how can you ever unplug? How can you ever opt out? How can you ever do something that God doesn't want you to do? It's not possible. And even if the Jew reasons that there are many things which prevent him from serving God, he knows in his soul as a believer with absolute clarity that even these things which appear to prevent him have also been created in this moment by God from absolute nothingness. And thus, they cannot possibly be against the will of the Creator. How can a person say, right, that this is an obstacle? How can it be an obstacle? God is creating it. God can't obstruct himself. It doesn't make sense. How can they truly prevent his proper fulfillment of Judaism, which is what God truly wants, if God himself first created them at this very moment? How then does a Jew end up doing other than what his soul's clear understanding necessitates? The answer is, of course, he or she knows, but at that moment, they forget. And whether they forgot by accident or another type of forgetting, the bottom line is it constitutes an act of forgetfulness and forgetting. Because if a person was locked in at that moment and feeling God's presence and appreciating it and loving it and being grateful for it, person could not do something other than what God wants at that moment. It's only because a person is disconnected from that reality at that moment that otherness, other options become an option. Same thing with doing something that hurts another person that you love. It's only possible when at that moment you're not thinking about them. They're not filling your consciousness. If they were filling your consciousness, if you were aware and appreciative and loving at that very moment, you couldn't do something, you wouldn't do something to in any way compromise your relationship or do anything that puts that negatively affects the other person. So, in short, the kitzer, in short, in summary, what we're doing now is understanding that remembering and forgetting is not just, oh, I forgot to pick up, the eggs from the store. I remember to do so. No, it touches on a spiritual truth. Everything, every physical phenomenon begins with a spiritual reality, a spiritual form of it. And the spiritual form of remembering is being plugged into God. And a spiritual form of forgetting is being unplugged or disconnected from our Creator, which could lead to all sorts of disconnected activities. Let's continue 13b. When a Jew remembers, as a Jew should, all forms of the opposing forces are automatically nullified, and one fulfills the Torah and mitzvot to perfection, to the point of, quote, all your actions are for the sake of heaven, and know him in all your ways. At this point, the Jew feels no extraneous non-godly thoughts at all. When you and I are plugged in, there's no other option other than doing what we're meant to do. We're locked in, we're focused, we remember, we're connected, and we're on the right path. We're where we need to be. That's the Yetzer, exactly. In other words, the Yetzer Hara is always trying to get us to forget. Don't worry about God. Take God out of your mind. Let's look at something else. Whereas the Yetzer Tov, the good inclination, says, think about God. Think about purpose. Think about soul. Think about what you need to think about. It's literally the difference between connection and disconnection. When you're connected, you're connected. When you're disconnected, you're disconnected. Connection is remembering. Disconnection is forgetting. By the way, you ever hear the expression out of sight, out of mind?
Yes.
What does it mean? When you're disconnected by space, you can forget. So forgetfulness is the concept. It's intertwined with disconnection. And connection, when you're right there with someone, you're not forgetting them because you're there with them. So connection is memory, and disconnection is forgetfulness. So now we understand something. Now we understand what is the notion of a knot. What does a knot do? Quite literally, you take two pieces of rope and you tie them together. What do they do? It connects. A knot connects. Knot is connection. What is connection? Memory. Hold on, are you with me on this? I know we're tying a bunch of strands together. Right, but what is memory? Memory is connection. What is connection? Connection is tying a knot. So physically, let's talk about the physical manifestation. It makes sense why people for many thousands of years have tied knots to remember something. Because what does it mean? It means I want to attach myself and my conscious awareness to the thing and not forget it. I want to bind my memory to this task, to this person, to this theme, to this Torah teaching, to whatever it is. I want to remember God, the Exodus, Torah, mitzvot, the eggs at the store, the thing that I keep on forgetting to take care of on Shabbat, I want to remember it. How do I remember it? By binding myself to it. How do I symbolize in a physical way the binding of myself in my mind to this thing so as not to forget? I tie a knot and it reminds me to bind myself to this idea, to this memory, to this notion. Let's look at text 15a. This is an explanation of the Rebbe, page 153. The Rebbe says, from the spiritual source of matters, that a spiritual knot negates any connection to negativity, the concealment of God, comes about in the physical reality as well. I told you the law of gravity. If it exists, if there's a spiritual truth, it has a physical manifestation. That making a physical knot helps nullify one's literal physical forgetfulness. So if you want to remember something, tying a physical knot can help. Why? Because spiritually, if you don't want to forget God, it means tying yourself, binding yourself with God so as not to forget. And thus we arrive at an incredible notion, an incredible idea. If you and I want to remain, if you and I want to remember God, it means to be, and not forget God, what it means is to forge connections. It means creating actual, real connections. So what does God show Moses? God says, you want to see me? You want to have a relationship with me? You want to remember me? You want to be one with me? Great. In your life. And teach this to the people. Put it in Torah. So that you and I, 3,000 years later, can study it and be inspired, hopefully be inspired by it. What is the message? God says, you want to remember me? You want to be associated with me? Fantastic. Remember the knot. Memory is tied to connection. And connection is great in theory, but it's more profound when it's practical, like those physical knots that we tie to remember concepts and things and themes and ideas. The same thing is true with our spiritual connection. Our spiritual connection is based on the idea of tying actual practical knots, binds that connect us in a practical way, which means if we want to be close to God, the question is, on a daily basis, how are we tying ourselves to God? What are we doing? How much time are we dedicating to bind ourselves with God? How long are we investing in prayer, speaking to God? How long are we investing in studying God's wisdom? How much time are we investing in doing what God wants us to do? Prayer, study, and mitzvot. Three things that bind us to God. The question is, are we tying those knots or are we not tying those knots? Right. You want to remember God? Great. Memory is connection. Tying that knot. God says, Moses, you want to see my face? You want to see my glory? Guess what? There's no quick fix. You want to see God? Tie the knots every single day. Do the things that you need to do. Study Torah, pray, and do a mitzvah. That's how we see God. And now we understand the juxtaposition and the connection between the two narratives, where God shows Moses the knot of his tefillin, and God teaches Moses how to pray. God says to Moses, essentially, you want my mercy, my compassion, my kindness, my love? Again, you want a relationship with me? Great! Take a look at the knot. What are you doing about it? You want to remember God? Great! There's no magic formula. Day in, day out. It's about doing the little things that keep the relationship up. If you have a good friend and life pulls you in different towns and different cities, after a short amount of time, certainly a long amount of time, you will fall out of that friendship. I don't mean that you're not going to be friends anymore and you won't reconnect or whatever it is, but you're not going to have the same feeling of that kinship, of that friendship, unless you do the little things to keep up the friendship. You call them on their birthday. You Facebook message them. You send them a card. You pick up the phone and discuss, you know, family stuff, whatever it is. It's the little things, the little points of connection, those little knots that we tie that keep us in that relationship with the other. And so God says to Moses, I want to teach you two things, the secret of prayer and the secret of my glory. And it's one and the same. If you want to pray and you want to have a connection with me and you want to have my glory, sorry, and you want to have my mercy and my forgiveness and my love, if you want me, great. What are you going to do about it? What are you doing today about it? What are the knots that you're tying? There's no magic. That's the point. Fine. Let's take a look at text 15b and close it out. Text 15b. This is also the connection between you will see my back and you will be shown the knot of the tefillin, which This is also the connection between you will see my back and you will be shown the knot of the tefillin, number one, with, number two, God teaching Moses the words for requesting mercy. When God taught Moses how to request mercy, which repairs the damage of the transgression, he showed him what fixing a transgression truly means. He did so by revealing the knot of his tefillin, connoting a powerful connection and knot, and the memory of the holy tefillin, and more specifically, that everything is created every moment by God. In other words, when we do the things that remind us that every moment we are created by God and we are meant to be in a relationship with God, at that point, we put ourselves in a place where we are automatically in God's grace, in God's favor, and the recipients of God's mercy. You want the benefits of the relationship? You got to invest in the relationship. That's the message of tonight. You want to remember? You want to be remembered? You got to remember. You want to remember? You got to tie some knots. So every day, let's tie some knots in whatever way we can. Everyone's different. For some people, every day it's going to be about putting some money in a tzedakah box, a few coins in a pushka in a tzedakah box, and that way they channel that through that chesed, through acts of kindness. For some people, it's going to be about Torah study. Some people, it's about prayer. Some people, it's about a combination. But whatever it is, let's make sure that every day, no day goes by without tying some knots to remember God and be present in that incredible relationship that we have. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah studies.
Didn't that blue thread on the come from a big fish or something, the color blue? The